WBUR.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The American empire is real. Like it or not, it's how the world sees the impact of the United States of America. Conservative members of William Kristol's Project for a New American Century say it's time to embrace a new American imperialism without apology. Tonight, America, the 21st century, and the new imperialists. First, the Bush education bill passed in the Senate today with a vote of 87 to 10. It's considered to be the most significant education reform effort in decades. Diana Jean Shemmo is a reporter with the New York Times in Washington. Diana Jean Shemmo, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi. Tell us about the bill the Senate passed today. How big a victory is this for the Bush administration, and what will the impact of the bill be?
Well, I think for the Bush administration, it's obviously a significant victory. Mr. Bush started out his term the day after his inauguration unveiling his education plan. And so, he called it No Child Left Behind, and mm-hmm. that was a phrase that we heard repeatedly today. In the galleries, we saw Rod Page, who's the education secretary, Sandy Kress, and Margaret Spellings, formerly LaMontagne, who is his domestic policy advisor. So the White House clearly had its imprint from start to finish on this bill.
And what will the impact of the bill be on American education?
Well, the most obvious impacts, I think, are going to be annual testing for school children in grades 3 to 8 in reading and math. But that won't really kick in until 2005, 2006. What we'll see more immediately, I think, is starting with the next school year, you'll see schools that have been labeled as persistently failing schools. Some of them will, about 3,000 of them, the Department of Education estimates, will have to start offering their children supplemental services. It could be private tutoring by somebody like a private for-profit company, or it could be something like the Boys Club of America, mm-hmm. or it could be an after-school program run by the Catholic Church or a Jewish school. Any kind of a private enterprise that is approved by the state can provide this kind of tutoring services for kids in failing schools. Another 6,700 schools have been identified as schools that are failing for a long enough period of time that the states will have to offer children the option of attending other public schools within the district that are not failing.
And is there money attached to the bill that will pay for these new requirements?
There is a substantial increase in funds. There's about overall $4 billion more than last year. That's for Title I, which is the one that targets poor schools. There's a 20% increase. What's really significant about the Title I increase, though, is not just the money. It's that there's a formula for any new money coming in will have to go to the very poorest schools. Up until now, the Title I money has been divided up in part on the basis of poverty, but then also to assure an even distribution, many states will send the money to areas, to schools where there's less poverty, but just to assure an even distribution. And so the new money will kind of more, they hope, more successfully target the most direly poor schools.
Who was pushing that particular element of the bill? Was that a Republican or Democrat or both initiative on that front?
I think that was more of a Democratic initiative, that specific one. But there are a number of other initiatives, like the one I mentioned about the private tutoring, that were more associated with the Republican side. This bill is really a product of both of them kind of working together. And the White House, I think, the compromise on what they call adequate yearly progress, which is essentially a fancy way of saying how do states measure the progress that kids are doing and what do they need to do each year to be doing okay. That's something that came from the White House, and it's modeled on what Texas did.
What will this national testing look like? Is it one test, or are there compromises? What's the outcome there?
It's actually it's two animals. It's not one. There's there's one that is a requirement that each state has to give an annual test, and that the state can designate. The states since 1994 have been engaged in this process where they've had to identify what their standards are, align the curriculum to the state standards, and then devise tests that will measure performance. Now, the new requirement is that states are free to choose their own tests, but then they have to use something called the National Assessment of Education Progress, which is something that is a kind of sample-based test. It's not given to all children. It's given to samples of kids, and they each take samples of questions.
So will we be able to compare results in Oklahoma and Vermont?
Through the NAEP, you can. You can't use just the state tests, because the tests that are going to be administered in the state of Oklahoma will be different from the state of Vermont, but they will both have to take the NAEP. And so you can compare their NAEP scores and know how rigorous their state standards are.
People are calling it the biggest education legislation in many decades. You agree?
I do agree. I mean, I think probably the most significant one before this was the Title I funding in 1965. And that, funnily enough, when it was passed, the intention was that it would also measure performance. I mean, it was meant to close the gap between rich and poor. Somehow, the second part never actually got put into place. So this is kind of, you could say it's the most significant, or you could say it's sort of the other shoe falling from the 1965 legislation.
Diana, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Diana Jean Shemmo is a reporter with the New York Times in Washington. Unlike past empires, the new American empire does not exactly have territorial ambitions. Its goals, say the new imperialists, should be uniquely American, to defend and disseminate the values of liberty, equality, and free market capitalism. What should America's role in the world be in the 21st century? What brand of American leadership is needed in the Middle East and Afghanistan? Are you ready for the new American empire? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington is William Crystal. He's editor of the Weekly Standard and chairman of the Project for the New American Century. Good evening, William Crystal.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're well, thanks. Thanks for joining us. And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is special coverage news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
So, William Crystal, we want to be sure that we're defining our terms correctly here. The project for, what have we got here? The new American century, of course, is talking about an American empire and talking about it unabashedly. What do you mean by it?
Well, I'm a little abashed, actually. It's my colleague Tom Donnelly is a little more willing to use the term. But Jefferson actually used the term Empire of Liberty to characterize the United States, and I would be happy with liberal empire or empire of liberty or just American global leadership on behalf of American principles, which I think are universal principles of freedom and democracy. We are the only superpower in the world, I think, to the degree that we have a peaceful and reasonably healthy world order, which is friendly to self-government, friendly to democracy, which helps enforce peace, helps prevent genocide and ethnic cleansing and that sort of thing, helps prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction to states that might use them or to terrorist groups that might use them. To the extent that we have any of that, it really is because of American security guarantees, because of American leadership, because of American-led alliances. This is not a go-it-alone proposition. This is a question of leading other countries, working with other countries. But I think we have shunned over the last 10, 12 years in a bipartisan way, really, some of our responsibilities around the world. We saw some of the price for that, I think, on September 11th. And it's worth at least throwing out the provocative term empire, perhaps liberal empire would be better, to at least force people to think hard about the extent to which the things we care about around the world and the things most people care about around the world depend on American strength, on American willingness to use force if necessary, on American willingness to be aggressive an American willingness to be aggressive diplomatically on behalf of our interests and our principles. And that's really what we're arguing for.
So you're talking about then a liberal empire, but it's an empire with plenty of teeth. If I understand correctly, you'd like to see the military spending go back to maybe 10% of GDP.
No, that was the New York Times for some reason. I know it's shocking to hear this, but they got that a little bit wrong.
We must be joking.
That's right. The subtle sense of humor of the New York Times, so subtle a lot of people don't catch it. Right now we spend about 3% of our gross domestic product on defense spending.
Where would you like to see
it? It's the lowest it's been since Pearl Harbor. It was, 6.5% just 15 years ago. I'd like to see it around 3.5%. That would be a $50-75 billion increase. It would allow us to do some things that we need to do in terms of developing new weapons, building up the size of our ground forces a little bit, replenishing some of the stuff we've used in this current war. more, just generally being a little more able, a little more confident when we have two or three challenges at once to be able to meet them. We've done a good job in Afghanistan, but I think people are a little shocked to discover that it's taken, you know, 40% of the U.S. Navy's aircraft carriers to go fight a war against a really small little country, frankly, in Afghanistan, that we've had to move all kinds of forces into the area.
Yeah.
And we would be in some trouble now if North Korea decided to cause trouble, if trouble flared up again in Kosovo or in Bosnia. We need a little bit, we need a bigger defense establishment, but not a big one by American standards over the last 50 years.
So give us the number again. I'm afraid it slipped by me, Bill Kristol. What are you looking for?
Well, we've argued for about a $50 to $75 billion defense increase. You could do it by about $15 billion a year over the next 5 years. You might want to do it a little faster. We could afford it. It would get us up to about 3.6% of GDP, which is where we were just a few years ago. We have slid. Defense spending as a percentage of our national spending has slid dramatically over the last 15 years, really been halved as a percentage of our national budget. We can afford to take it back up a little bit.
So, but once this world empire, this word empire gets in the mix, people, of course, think of Rome. They think of the British Empire. That's the most recent precedent, I guess. What are the distinction you'd draw between the kind of white man's burden of the British Empire and the liberal empire you'd like to see America pursue?
Well, it's not a territorial empire, obviously, the way the British Empire was in India. But look, the phrase liberal empire, I believe, was invented by the great British historian, the great liberal British historian Macaulay in the mid-19th century. And what he meant was this, that other empires rule for the sake of the home country. Mm-hmm. They exploit the local populations. They think it's important to conquer other countries for their own self-defense or their own economic well-being. The British Empire, at least at its best, did try to bring self-government to the countries they ruled. It was a messy and bloody process at times, but at the end of the day, India became a functioning democracy, and thanks in part to developments that took place under the tutelage of the British. We're obviously not going to go in with a white man's burden sort of attitude, as the British did have for much of the 18th and 19th century, but a liberal empire somewhat along the British model, but really of a distinctively American sort, is what I think we're talking about. And really, it's what exists, incidentally, in parts of the world. What are we doing in places like Kosovo and Bosnia? Mm-hmm. But intervening to prevent terrible things from happening and helping them develop self-government and hope with keeping troops there for a while to help the local governments, as we've kept troops in Japan and Korea and in Germany to help preserve safety and security. But ultimately, you know, they govern themselves. We don't tell them what to do. We have alliance structures to help preserve peace and stability around the world. The other thing about the British Empire, people forget, is one thing they did do was abolish the slave trade around the world. And they did that not for selfish reasons. They did that because they thought it was right. And there is a way in which if you are a great power, you could actually make good things happen around the world if you have the courage of your convictions.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Are you ready to see the United States step up to bring its values in a more forceful way to the world?
Well, one is all for values. My mind boggled when I saw the Times piece, so I was thrown off. I mean, the 10% of GDP on defense, that threw me way off.
Times humor, as Bill Kristol said.
Yeah, Times humor, indeed. But, you know, we've got to take the measure of this. I mean, to a certain extent, we are the Romans already. I don't know about you, Tom, but most Americans can take, at best, 2 weeks of very anxious vacation a year. If you lived in Germany, you get 5 weeks. You need to send a kid to school in Germany, don't worry. The state will take care of it. Lose your job in Germany, don't worry about health insurance. That's all paid for. Who's paying for it? We are. We have been. For the last decade, a half, all through the Cold War, but pointlessly in the last decade, half of our defense spending, half of our tax money to defense has gone to the defense of Europe against whom? You know, we are already paying the costs of empire in the things that we have to forego here at home. Dwight Eisenhower, no doubt, said that every dollar spent on weapons is a dollar taken away from schools, a dollar taken away from, you know, nutrition, a dollar taken away from roads. We're already paying and paying for things we really don't get back in return. So I'm very dubious about the financial cost of this and the cost in terms of what Americans have to sacrifice for it.
It's not easy being imperial, I guess, but that's what's being proposed tonight. We're talking about a new American empire, a liberal empire, as William Crystal calls it, an empire of values and maybe something more. There's a lot of steel in it as well. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255 or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR
22.
This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a new American empire, maybe one we have no choice but to take up. Wonder what you think. Can America fight for its values in a dangerous world without commanding an empire? Or do you trust that a more assertive America will put values ahead of raw commercial interests? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Bill Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard and chairman of the Project for the New American Century, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Bill Crystal, just before the break, Jack Beatty put it to us that the cost of being the new Romans is extraordinarily high and that we all pay for it right down to our very personal lives. You agree?
No. I mean, I think Jack misspoke slightly on the statistics there. It's kind of New York Times statistics, we'll now have to call them. We have about 100,000 troops in Europe. We have about 1.4 million men and women under in our armed services. I mean, no estimate of the cost of the troops in Europe runs to more than 10 or 15% of the defense budget, and that's probably high since it's not clear that if you brought them all home, you still wouldn't want to keep some of them in arms. And it helps to have forward deployed troops in Europe. You know, it helps to have bases in Germany and elsewhere if you're going to have to deploy to the Middle East, to Afghanistan, obviously to Bosnia and Kosovo. So it's not clear that having the 100,000 troops that are left in Europe costs much at all. You know, maybe if you shrank the army by 100,000, you'd save some money, but that's by no means a major component of our defense spending. Defense spending is down. It's down as a percentage of GDP massively over the last 15 years. It by no means is a, you know, we can afford 3% of GDP on defense. We can afford 3.5% of GDP on defense. We can afford to double the State Department diplomatic spending right now. It would barely make a dent in the overall federal budget. So it's really not. I think there are serious arguments about this, but I don't actually think cost is a major one.
What about it, Jack? Maybe it's not so expensive to be assertive, or after September 11th, maybe we can't afford not to be assertive.
Maybe not, but I maintain that the cost of empire is something. I mean, we are paying now around the world for the defense of countries whose standard of living, whose quality of life exceeds our own. And one reason is because they're not paying for the cost of their own defense. You know, the conservatives apply the welfare model to individuals in America. If the state is doing for you, you don't have the incentive to do for yourself. Well, you know, that has been what we have done across the world in our so-called alliance systems, which really are, well, you write the checks and you station the troops, and if we need you, we'll call on you. And meanwhile, we'll have our welfare states. That is a cost to the American taxpayer. And one of the promises of the end of the Cold War was that we could, you know, in the immortal words of George McGovern, come home, America. We could begin to realize, wait a minute, what are we paying for and what are we getting in return? You know, years and years ago, Walter Lippmann said, stationing forward deployment into Korea or Japan or Europe is an expensive and dangerous way to go about defending ourselves. We need a blue water defense policy. That is to say, a naval strategy that would keep us in around Europe, but not necessarily in Europe and other places as well. So, the taxpayers are paying for this empire, and what they're getting back, I suppose they're getting back a kind of security, but at what price and against what enemy? And what I hear in this talk of the new American empire is a kind of building up of the defense establishment almost as a manifest of national pride and not sort of scaled to what seem to be the real challenges of our defense.
Lippmann was wrong, McGovern was wrong, and Beatty is wrong. A distinguished company to which to be wrong, I would say, but it's just not the case. Germany spends not that much less as a percentage of their GDP on defense than we do. They have had until very, very recently a mandatory universal draft. It's just not fair to say that these other countries are not defending themselves. We think it is in our national interest to keep enough troops in Europe to reassure everyone about American engagement in Europe to prevent what has been the history of Europe over the last couple of centuries. It would not be any cheaper to have them floating around on aircraft carriers than to be, in fact, it would be more expensive than to have them stationed in bases in Germany and elsewhere. Now, we could argue whether you still need 100,000, whether you want to have 50,000 troops in Europe, but that is a trivial expense. Now, there is a serious argument, as Jack alludes to, as to whether we want to be this kind of global policeman, if you want to use that word, whether it's in our interest. I think Korea and Germany and Japan, where we have kept troops for 50 years in a way that Walter Lippmann would not want us to, are huge American success stories. The fact that we have 30,000 troops in Korea and 50,000 troops in Japan helps prevent an arms race in Asia, which has saved us and a lot of other people huge amounts of expenditures, possible expenditure of blood, possible military involvement over the last 50 years. Those are success stories.
Mike Mansfield called Japan the unsinkable aircraft carrier. But apart from the cost, it's a huge and important issue. We may not settle it in this hour. But there's the other thing that resonates interestingly here. Jack Beatty quotes George McGovern saying, "Come home, America." And in some sense, that sounds a lot like George Bush's campaign theme on foreign policy. And what you, Bill Kristol, conservative, are speaking in favor of here tonight seems to be taking us in a much more internationalist direction than our own Republican president, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Tom. I think George Bush has changed a bit since September 11th, and I'm in a way that I welcome. No, I think the Republican Party over the last decade has had strong isolationist tendencies, if you want to call them that, or let's say tendencies to wish to withdraw from messy spots of the world or not intervene in the first place, whether it was Haiti or Bosnia or Kosovo. And I've quarreled with that. I think those have been short-sighted on those arguments have been short-sighted on the part of Republicans as they were on the part of Democrats in earlier times. But you're right. There are strong tendencies in both parties. In the Democratic Party, there are more traditional liberal aversion to military force tendencies. In the Republican Party, they're often more kind of Buchananite, nationalistic, protectionist, we don't want to mess around with foreigners tendencies. But both of them, and others as well, have made us excessively cautious, in my view, about intervening. I think we could have saved a lot of deaths in the 90s if we'd intervened earlier in Bosnia in 91, 92, in Africa in 94, and I think it would have been in our interest to do so. I think being much more aggressive in the war on terrorism throughout the 90s would have been in our interest. Now, I'm not saying that every intervention everywhere, of course, is a good idea. One has to be prudent and sensible. But I think we need to recognize the fact that there's a world out there that pretty active American diplomacy and where necessary military involvement can make a big difference in that world and can make a big difference for the good. And stepping back over the short term might look attractive. You save a little money. You don't get your hands dirty. But over the medium and longer term can become very dangerous.
Bill Kristol, I want to take this into a test case that we've talked and thought a lot about on this show, just to be sure I understand what you're saying. Let's look at the Middle East. Let's take, for example, Saudi Arabia, a country where many American values are taboo and where there's an indigenous, government-supported religious ideology, the Wahhabis, that's very antagonistic toward the West. Are you suggesting that this more assertive posture in defense or even in propagation of American values would mean that we would be tougher on Saudi Arabia? We would push our values even there?
Yes. Now, let me just one obvious caveat, which is I don't believe we can remake all 180 countries in the world into the image of the United States, and I don't think we should try to. But where other countries are pursuing policies, in the case of Saudi Arabia, where they're exporting Wahhabi, they're not just using it internally, they're exporting, in effect, terrorism now, and both inadvertently, but to some degree willingly, as a way of deflecting criticism from their own regime. I do think we need to fundamentally reconsider our policy towards Arab nations. I think we've been much too soft on dictatorships in Arab nations. We seem to have this premise that Arab peoples wouldn't like to govern themselves just like everyone else does. And I think we need to be much more aggressive in pushing for democracy or movement toward democracy in these nations, as we did in Latin America in the 70s and 80s and 90s, to good effect, as we've done in Asia with Korea and Taiwan and other nations. Now, you know, you can't snap your fingers and overnight bring democracy to countries, but I think you need to hold it out as a goal and not get into alliances which, you know, maybe in some short-term ways are necessary, but over the long term really can cause that is alliances with certain kinds of governments that really undercut our own interests and our own principles.
And Jack Beatty, what about that? We've talked about it on this show. It's a dangerous minefield. I've heard you speak in favor of supporting American values there, but surely if we get serious about that's a moment when you would want to have a pretty big stick in case things go wrong.
Oh, sure, and I'm not arguing against a big stick. I'm just saying it's big enough, and we need to ask, we need to set priorities about how to use it and where to use it. We can't do everything. And the assumption that I sort of hear behind some of the rhetoric in the New York Times piece, at least, was that we should be prepared to do everything. And that seems to me to be an insupportable burden for this country and an unnecessary one. We want to encourage our values, but here's a way in which, again, I think Bill's emphasis differs from traditional Republican foreign policy, which stresses American interests, business interests especially. The Bush administration is in many ways the most corporocentric Republican administration in my lifetime, certainly, where, the values are okay, but interests are forever. What about that, Bill? Is this sort of a critique of interest-based foreign policy where oil and strategy are the only things that matter?
Yeah, it is. I think we're Reagan Republicans and Teddy Roosevelt Republicans more than Bush Republicans, though I think over the last few months, Bush has become a little more of a Teddy Roosevelt Republican himself. Look, interests are important. This is the real world we're operating in, and I don't mean to be cavalier in dismissing them. But no, I, for example, have objected and do object to the corporate domination of aspects of our foreign policy, especially with regard to China, for example, where I think we've been much too accommodating to the dictatorship there. Not so much because of, much as I wish it was because of kind of liberal weak needness. It's not really as much as it is due to a good old-fashioned Republican corporate commercial interests. You can't let commerce is important. I'm a free trader, basically. But you can't let commerce drive your entire foreign policy.
Fascinating. We can hear the old lines kind of changing and moving here. Bill Kristol, you don't sound like the kind of Republican that Bush came into office being, and yet there's this new urge to support values when we see such challenges to fundamental American values around the world. And now, even from the mouths of conservatives, it's a fascinating new moment. Listeners, can America lead the world without overseeing an empire? We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can join us. Bud is on the line. Welcome, Bud. You're on the air.
Hi. I think that when Bill Kristol talks about the successes of our policy, he shouldn't be comparing the past with the present.
What are you thinking of in particular, Bud?
Because I'm thinking of when you've got two superpowers duking it out.
Mm-hmm.
That's one situation. When we are the only superpower, then you start getting into a situation where the cost, I agree with Beatty, that the costs are going to rise way beyond what they're worth. And at that point, I'm looking at the Afghani situation in the long run, and I'm saying, how in the world do you force democracy there? What meaning does that have in that country? If you get down to the ground level of the cultural stuff.
So what's the alternative vision, though, Bud? Look what happened when we stepped out of Afghanistan and turned our back on it.
Yes, but what I'm saying is something that I've read recently, and it makes a lot of sense to me, is that the people that are best able to take care of that are the regional powers, and we should be giving more to them because it's in their interest to maintain stability in those regions. I don't see why we have to step in every time and talk about how wonderful American values are when we tend to impose inappropriate values, political solutions, because of our own American experience.
Bud, thanks for your call. Bill Kristol, what about it? Do you see the recent action in Afghanistan as an appropriate projection of American power in line with the thinking you're espousing here tonight?
Yeah, I do. And look, I'm for using regional powers and allies, obviously, where appropriate. But I think what happened in Afghanistan is exactly, unfortunately, that we did defer to a regional power. In 1989, after the Soviet Union had left, we basically let Pakistan determine our Afghan policy. Pakistan got in bed with very unsavory elements, and the Pakistani intelligence service in particular was very fond of the precursors to the Taliban and then the Taliban itself. Osama bin Laden found a base there. And we're paying a big price for excessive deference to one particular regional power. In that case, regional powers have their own interests. One advantage of being a sort of not regional power is that you can come in and balance some of the regional powers. You can do it without huge deployments of forces. I don't know what's going to happen in Afghanistan. It's not going to look like, you know, the state of Massachusetts or Vermont. Well, maybe it will look more like Massachusetts, but not like Vermont, not like a pristine democracy over the next several months or years. But there's no reason it can't be a much more decent place than it's been for the last 10 years. In fact, the truth is, before the Russians went in the mid-70s in Afghanistan, they had quite a decent constitutional monarchy with a fair amount of free speech and liberty in Afghanistan for about 10, 12 years, rather decentralized and not obviously very developed. You could get back to something like that. And I think if it takes 1,500 British troops, a few thousand other troops, some American logistical and material support for that, that's a good investment. And that's exactly the kind of thing I'm thinking about, in fact, that you go in, you do your military operation where you have to, where you've been attacked, and I don't think anyone would quarrel much with that. Mm-hmm. And then you work with allies to try to at least prevent things from spinning back out of control. You don't try to turn every place into a mini Vermont, as I say.
Mm-hmm. Bill Kristol says, if you're queasy about military intervention when it's necessary to support values, get over it. It's time for it, he says. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Rory's on the line. Welcome, Rory. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'll be brief as much as possible. Anyways, my suggestion would be to stay away from the idea of sort of hegemonistic leadership, because historically it's been proven not to work, at least for not too long a period. I would rather suggest that, you know, the U.S. should be more of a facilitator or a conflict resolver whenever possible and problem solver. I think we're being short-sighted again by just because we, you know, got rid of a bunch of, you know, thugs and bandits and caves. We are thinking that, you know, we're just, you know, in a position to be in a leadership position or start a new empire, so to speak, because first of all, I mean, for problems, you know, we are selling about 85% of the world's weapons, causing 45% of the world population. There's already enough resentment. 1.5 to 1.8 million, billion Muslims are not quite sure how the whole thing's going to turn out.
We got it, Roy. We got it. Let's give Bill a chance to respond before the break. And thank you for your call, Bill Kristol. What about it? The U.S. as a facilitator and problem solver instead of a hegemonist.
Well, I'm for facilitating and problem solving, but I don't think one can blink the fact or should avoid the fact that at the end of the day, there does have to be a big stick behind it, and not everyone's going to be cheerfully willing to have their problems facilitated by us. Mm. And there are times when I think we need to have the muscle behind it to put down people who aren't interested in mediation or interested in imposing themselves on their neighbors and on being extremely cruel and dictatorial in their ways. So I don't think facilitation's enough.
But one big value we've sort of ducked, especially in the Bush administration, is cooperation. Isn't that also a 21st century value?
Sure, and I'm, you know, we're cooperating with people and fighting the war in Afghanistan, but again,
sort
cooperation
of,
on
not
what basis?
Many, mostly American troops.
Well, no, we have most everyone on our side, actually, but cooperation on what basis and for what end, and cooperation for cooperation's sake with a bunch of dictatorships, or in the United Nations, where we pretend that Syria, let's cooperate with Syria on the Security Council to fight terrorism. I'm not particularly keen on that kind of cooperation.
Bill Kristol is saying, let's clear the decks and stand up to our American responsibilities globally. Do you see why he's arguing for acceptance of a new kind of liberal empire? And if you choke on the idea of empire, what's your alternative? Can America lead the world without overseeing an empire? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Bill Kristol about the idea of a new American empire, a liberal empire, standing up for American values around the world with plenty of steel behind that posture. Bill Kristol's editor of the Weekly Standard and chairman of the Project for a New American Century. We're also joined by Jack Beattie, our Special Coverage news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Can America fight for its values in a dangerous world without commanding an empire? Dana is on the line. Welcome, Dana. You're on the air.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hi. I would like to say, I don't know whether to laugh or cry at this self-congratulatory, benevolent rhetoric of liberal empire. I mean, that sounds so euphemistic, especially given the United States' track record. Tom, you hit it right on the head with your introductory remarks when you were saying what America will export ever so benevolently and liberally. When you said free market, that was it right there. This is all for business. This is just a way of getting, you know, of serving American businesses cheap labor, resources. I don't think the United States was too interested in so-called liberal values when President Bush gave the Afghanistan, the Taliban, a lot of millions of dollars for this ostensible drug war. So I really don't think we're about spreading liberal values. We'll use rhetoric like that for corporate self-interest, but I honestly don't think that we're interested in. So the idea of the word empire in a democracy tends to send shivers up my spine.
Got it. Dana, you're not buying it, and we hear it loud and clear. Bill Kristol, what about it? You hear this immediate concern that this kind of talk becomes, or this kind of posture becomes, behind values, becomes a Trojan horse for raw U.S. power, raw U.S. interests. And of course, we have fallen off the track sometimes in the past on exactly that danger. How do we promote U.S. interests or I should say values in a bold way without that becoming a kind of Trojan horse for something much less admirable?
Well, I don't think incidentally promoting markets is unadmirable.
I'm not saying markets in particular, but,
right,
you know, so power can skew markets as well as it can promote free markets.
It can, and undoubtedly has, and undoubtedly will again. Look, I don't actually use the term empire much, but in a way, precisely the term empire suggests that commercial considerations don't come first. I mean, empires are not particularly matters of commercial self-interest, and most businessmen aren't terribly interested in American intervention in Afghanistan or Bosnia or Kosovo or Haiti, to take the most recent four examples. The Kuwait was a little different because their oil was at stake, though I think we should have gone on and finished the job against Saddam and liberated the Iraqi people, which would have proved that we weren't in it just for economic reasons. But certainly in the 90s, in the last decade, we've intervened in Haiti, Bosnia, Kosovo, and now Afghanistan. Pretty hard for me to see that any of those is of great concern to major American corporations.
Not extraordinarily lucrative terrain.
No.
Nor was
Vietnam. I mean, nor was Korea. You know, we've lost a lot of people in wars and in battles that were not primarily motivated. They may have been foolish in some ways, but they were not primarily motivated by economic self-interest.
How about it, Jack Beattie? Bill Kristol says we'll be large and in charge in defense of our values, and it's not about projecting commercial interests. And the record, he says, bears that out.
I agree with him. I mean, certainly if Vietnam had even a tincture of the rationality of economic interests, I mean, the whole we would have disengaged from the conflict early on. There's a certain rationality about commerce and that's absent from sort of national greatness. And I heard, and I read with admiration, but also with ambivalence through the campaign. Bill Kristol's magazine, the Weekly Standard, was strong for the candidacy of John McCain, in whom they saw a president who could bring back the idea of national greatness in foreign policy. And it, as I say, it's attractive. We want to be a great country in the sense of being a good country. And we know Tocqueville didn't really say that, but it's frightening because you're sort of putting yourself out there for the whole world to aim at when you're aiming for national greatness. And you know, when you've got to sell that to the people, you've got to tell them, look, What happened? What's happening in Rwanda right now is something we have to stop right now. It's not going to pay us a dime, but we can't let this go on and respect ourselves. If we ever had an administration that could say that to the people, that would really show that something like Bill Kristol's Empire of Liberty was real. But I don't know that George Bush would have done anything different from what Bill Clinton did, which was to ignominiously duck and really prevent the rest of the world from intervening to stop Rwanda.
How about it, Bill Kristol? Are we smoking something here? Is Washington really going to take on that kind of true mantle of the defense of liberty globally, and the Republican Party becomes the global liberal revolution?
Well, no. I mean, Jack makes a fair point, but the only way they'll do it is if, I guess, people like me succeed in popularizing the idea and persuading political leaders to embrace it. You can't. In fact, the problem with something like Rwanda is when you are unaccustomed to thinking of the American purpose in any broad or grander way than making money or some very precise defense of particular countries. Of course, no president, no matter how much goodwill he might have had, could have persuaded people in a few days that we have to intervene suddenly in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. You really need to lay the basis for that by sketching a picture of the world and of America's role in it that would justify such an intervention. So in a way, that's exactly what I'm trying to do in my little way, and I hope it's not too scary for Jack and for others, but don't worry, it's not having quite as much influence, not having enough influence to be scary at least yet. The other point I would make, maybe a little more seriously, is and this is the point my colleague Tom Donnelly particularly was making in that New York Times Magazine interview, is that people out there think we are an empire, whether we think we are or not. So we can tell ourselves, let's be modest. Let's not be presumptuous, and I'm obviously for a certain amount of modesty too. But people out there see a huge country which willy-nilly is exporting its values around the world, which willy-nilly is a huge economic player in the world, which does have interests and troops scattered around the world for good reasons in many cases. And in a certain way, there's just an advantage of saying, well, let's at least be clear-eyed about how others see us. Let's be clear-eyed, therefore, about the decisions we make. Telling ourselves, gee, we don't want to be an empire, doesn't make that much sense if other people out there think you are a decisive player and look to you for leadership. We tried to let Europe take the lead with regard to Bosnia, for example, for 2 years. Clinton did. I don't really blame him, I suppose, for trying. It was not a silly thing necessarily. They were just incapable of getting their act together and moving in to stop Milosevic, and they needed our leadership. And if that's the case, we should just face up to that and not kid ourselves that, gee, it could all work out without our leadership, I think.
And what about Jack's allusion to the Republican Party, John McCain, George Bush? How do you see this line of thinking filtering into the Republican Party? And if it were adopted, if McCain had won, or if George Bush becomes your liberal imperialist, what does that do or not do for the Republican Party?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I mean, I think it becomes a more Reagan-Teddy Roosevelt-type party and a little less of a corporate McKinley party. It's interesting that Karl Rove, Bush's the president's top political advisor, always took McKinley in the 1896 election as sort of the model for Bush. I was more interested in Teddy Roosevelt, who succeeded McKinley. I preferred McCain to Bush. Many of my colleagues at the Weekly Standard didn't. We were split on that. The great irony is, since September 11th, you could argue that Bush is running something like a McCain presidency, and I don't say that in any way at all critical of Bush. I think he's done very well since September 11th. But the kinds of issues he's facing, the kind of rhetoric he's used, the call to a patriotic challenge, the putting aside of some of the littler concerns that he stressed earlier on, is in a funny way, McCain has... I don't know, the McCain candidacy lives somehow now in the rhetoric of the Bush presidency, I think.
Is this a winning strategy for Republicans?
I think it is. Well, I don't, it obviously depends on how well the particular interventions and policies work out. Mm-hmm. If it's Vietnam, it's not a winning strategy. If it's Afghanistan, it is a winning strategy. Mm-hmm. But I would say this. I think it is in the broader sense that I do think the big challenge to the Republican Party is being more than just the party of money, more than just the party of corporate interest. I think that had become, I'm more or less a conservative on most of these issues, but I do think that liberal criticism of the Republican Party had become somewhat accurate and somewhat politically effective by 2000. And in that respect, just from a political point of view, having a bigger notion of what the political party is about and what its vision of leading the nation is about, I think would help in a political sense. That's not the reason I'm for it particularly, but I do think it would be a more attractive vision. That's one reason McCain attracted a lot of people, that along with his reform agenda at home, who weren't necessarily traditional Republicans.
We're talking with Bill Kristol about a strong unabashed, value-oriented American leadership in the world, maybe even America at the head of an empire of liberty. Do you buy it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Joe is on the line. Welcome, Joe. You're on the air.
Thank you. How's everybody?
Everyone's well, thanks.
3 points. One is, I think that we're pursuing a policy these days that is probably not much different than we have since America became a world power in the early 20th century. It's just that the nature of what we do when we intervene depends on who's opposing us. And now that we have kind of an independent approach to intervention where we don't have the Soviet Union or China opposing us, when we're trying to protect some countries from, at the time, communism, the playing field is wide open as to how we use the influence we can wield with this intervention. Now,
we see that, Joe. Pull us to your bottom line there.
All right. The bottom line is that I think that we have to be willing to recognize that we can't. First, the Republican and the Democratic parties are pretty much indistinguishable in terms of their corporate links, and so when American government does something in the world, it's pretty clear to the rest of the world that it's being driven by our capitalistic drive, and the danger is going to come when we're not an empire of democracy. And I think that's the key, that if we're going to intervene, we should leave the nation or the peoples who are there with the mechanisms for a legal system, for a justice system, for an environmental protection system, and help them develop whatever form of government they want out of the institutions of democracy, and not necessarily link it to us being able to have access to their markets. In Rwanda, there were such...
Joe, we got it. Our time's running down. Let's cut it there. But we appreciate the point, and thank you for your call. Bill Kristol, Joe raises the extent. How far are you prepared to support this intervention? Are you suggesting, yes, let's go the distance. Let's go right in until countries who need it have not only the notion of democracy, but the institutions to carry it forward. And let's have Americans there promoting, even helping them build those.
Well, we do, in fact, have Americans scattered around the world trying to help people build democracies. That's more of a diplomatic effort than a military effort, obviously, and a lot of it is done through civic institutions, non-governmental institutions.
But we sense right something more muscular in what you're suggesting here.
Yeah, no, sure, because I think at the end of the day, a lot of that can be backed up at key moments by American military strength and American military force. Joe is right to say that what I'm advocating isn't that new, though. It is the tradition of Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, Ronald Reagan. I mean, it's not that different. It's not at all different, I would argue, from what their sense of America was. And Joe is also right to say that we have new conditions now, post-World War II, post-Cold War, no huge enemy. It's both easier and harder in some ways to know what America should do. The one concept we haven't really mentioned that I would just mention, though, people need to be serious about, whatever their views on liberal empire are, is weapons of mass destruction. I mean, people need to have a serious view. You can't just say, well, the Cold War is over. It's a much more scattered world. Come home, America. We need to have a serious view about how you handle the question of the proliferation, the development of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and the ability to deliver them. Now, there is a liberal view of this, which can be an arms control treaties view. You have to be then serious, you have to ask serious questions about how enforceable that is. Iraq is a signatory to the Biological Weapons Treaty, for example. If you're dubious about some of these treaties, and if you're not confident that you can just let countries like Iraq develop weapons of mass destruction, you have to have a serious conversation. The American people really need to have a serious conversation over the next few years about what it is, how it is we intend to live in a world, either it's to stop the proliferation of these weapons or somehow hope they never get used. Is deterrence enough? So I think that's one aspect that's left off. The usual account of these things is, well, there was World War II, then there's the Cold War, then the Cold War is over and things are sort of peaceful. But one forgets about this great new threat, which has been brought home to us in the last couple of months of weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm. Bill Kristol, you talk about empire more modestly than anyone I've ever known, but you always make us think, and we thank you for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Bill Kristol, William Kristol, is editor of the Weekly Standard and chairman of the Project for the New American Century. Jack Beatty, at the end of that, are you any more ready to pick up the call to a global large and in charge status?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's the Colin Powell called Kmart parents of America who have to pick up that burden in terms of their sons and daughters who have to, conduct these forward and aggressive policies. But I'm not, it seems to me that September 11th We have a much more McCain public now. The public is ready for a discussion about these things as they weren't before. I mean, the fear of casualties essentially inhibited American foreign policy throughout the 90s to our detriment. And now we can have a real conversation about that and about the whole notion of trying to stop problems before they reach us.
And we've got to listen, but like it, empire or not, the sound of values sounds good right now. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.